This is Future Water, where we talk about all the ways in which companies, utilities, and people are addressing the challenges and opportunities in water. Today, we're going to talk with Bluefield's Keith Hayes and Chloe Meyer about the Veolia Suez deal that appears to be coming to a close. At $15 billion U.S. dollars, that is, seems to be an acquisition worth discussing. Lots of intrigue, everything from poison pills to carve-outs or divestments to cultural issues, as well as some geographic strategies and sort of where the impacts and opportunities might be around the world. So before we do that, let's talk a little bit about news. Three news items today. Kimberly-Clark has reached a settlement over its so-called flushable wipes. It will include better labeling, manufacturing improvements, as well as some testing, which really signals, well, this is really a big win for U.S. cities and I guess municipal wastewater systems that have argued for a long time that these so-called flushable wipes, they're not really flushable, have caused significant sewer blockages for systems, and they're cost a lot of money to repair. And I think this has been in play for a while, but I think it really came to a head, at least in the news, after the toilet paper shortage, which was about a year ago. It was a run on toilet paper, definitely in the U.S., and people were doing everything they could, and so they were using flushable wipes. Everybody's working from home, and it was causing all kinds of problems over the past year. But like I said, these blockages, also known as fatbergs, have been in play for a long time for wastewater system operators. It'll gross you out, but you can go to Google and type in fatberg London, and you'll see some of these blockages that are hundreds of feet long in the pipes, and they have to be broken up by jackhammers in some cases. But as part of the proposed settlement, the water management system in Charleston, South Carolina, shout out to the hometown. Kimberly-Clark, who's the maker of Scott toilet paper, has agreed that its wipes will soon be labeled as flushable and meet wastewater industry standards by May of 2022. Litigation is still continuing against other companies such as Costco, Procter & Gamble, CVS, Target, Walgreens, and Walmart, among others. So big win for wastewater system operators. News item number two, Franklin Electric announced another acquisition. It acquired Puronix. Puronix is a residential and commercial water treatment products and services provider in, I'd say, 32 states in the U.S. Its annual sales, I believe, last year were about $24 million. Why are we interested in this? Well, Franklin continues, despite its name, Franklin Electric, Franklin really continues to build out its water position and sees water treatment as a strong complement to its groundwater pumping business. Franklin is also a top company in water that the Bluefields team of analysts keeps track of. It's publicly traded, and we look at it on a quarterly basis. And it's for the publicly traded companies we follow, it's definitely in the top 50 that we follow. So definitely worth keeping up with them, both in their expansion strategy or growth strategy, but also in their M&A deals. And lastly, news item number three, water officials in California have drafted a cease and desist order to force Nestle, the bottled water company, to stop pumping millions of gallons of water out of the San Bernardino Forest, which sells under its Arrowhead bottled water brand. And the reason for this is drought conditions in the Golden State continue to raise significant concerns going forward. We're at the end of the rainy season or just finishing it up in California, and drought is a real problem. Last year, Nestle drew 58 million gallons of water out of the San Bernardino Forest, which exceeded its allotment by about 2.5 million gallons. The California drought is real, and concerns are definitely high. And for this reason, even morning shows, you know, the Today Show in the U.S., they're talking about things like water reuse and reclaimed wastewater and, you know, alternative water supply. So it's a big issue. It will continue to be. It's no secret. Climate change is real. So keep in mind what's happening out west, but also just for news items. For those of you not in the know, Bluefield Research puts out its Waterline newsletter every Wednesday for registrants. It's quick. You just have to go to bluefieldresearch.com, sign up for the newsletter. You'll get some news items. You get data. There's some interesting data that we've been putting out recently that might be worth looking at. Every week you get it on Wednesday. Plus you also get other headlines that our team of analysts think is important to the water industry as a whole, not only in the US, but also globally. So go to Bluefield's website, sign up for the Waterline newsletter. There's a lot of good stuff out there. And then one other thing I might add is Bluefield on Tap. I joined Dave McGimsey once a month on the Water Values Podcast. Water Values Podcast, one of the best ones out there. So with Dave, I've actually going to record later this week, quick intro discussion with him. We're going to talk, I think, a little bit about data, something that I have in mind, but no promises. But you'll just have to sign up for the Water Values Podcast newsletter. But also you can, much like Future Water Podcast, you can go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe. You can also go to Spotify, Stitcher, and all the other podcast platforms. So don't be a stranger. Just subscribe, download. That way you don't have to come look for us. It'll come right into your pocket. So with that being said, let's get into the discussion with Chloe Meyer and Keith Hayes in Europe. All right, so I'm joined here today with by Chloe Meyer and Keith Hayes. So Chloe, how's it going?
Hello, I'm great. Happy to participate in my first Bluefield podcast.
Nice. So Chloe, you're a project consultant. You also do some analysis and research for us. You're obviously based in France. And then we've got Keith. Keith, how's it going?
It's going well, Reese. Hey, Chloe. Good to be talking about the future again.
Yeah, this is Keith and I've done this before where it's between Boston and Barcelona. And now we've got, I'm in Boston, Keith, you're in Spain, Chloe, you're in France. So we're going to really test the internet connections. Let me put it that way, the interweb. So the reason I asked you guys to join me today is this is actually our second Veolia Suez Future Water podcast. But it seems like the deal has happened or is about to close in May. So Chloe, you're, I guess, closer to the feet on the ground in France. And sort of that's why I think you could add some real value in the discussion. So let's talk a little bit about sort of how did we get here and what happened between Veolia and Suez.
So a few days ago, Veolia agreed to pay 20.5 euros a share for the roughly 70% of Suez it didn't already own. It bought its initial 30% stake in the company last year for 18 euros a share from the French company Engie. So the deal will leave some elements of Suez to continue as a new business owned by a variety of French shareholders and private equity groups. Suez will keep its French water and waste activities, its SES division, the Smart and Environmental Solutions division, as well as some other international water activities with overall around 7 billion euros in revenue. The deal initially provided that 40% of the future Suez will be owned by French investment fund Meridiam, while 40% will go to a consortium made of French investment fund Ardian and US-based private equity firm Global Infrastructure Partners, GIP. The remaining 20% are to be shared between the Caisse de dépôt et consignation and employees shareholders. The buyers of the new Suez have pledged to keep it for at least 10 years, although this may change in the future. A few days ago, however, Ardian, which has had backed Suez before the deal and did not participate in the last round of negotiations and declared that it was not consulted on the final agreement. Ardian deemed the deal as unacceptable and dropped out of it last week, considering that the relative portion of international activities in the new Suez is insufficient to ensure growth and to support Ardian's strategy. Further to that announcement, Meridiam declared itself ready to fill the gap And just yesterday, GIP announced that on its part, it will remain mobilized to be part of the new Suez project. And just this morning, a new player, the German waste specialist Remondis, expressed also interest to enter into Suez capital.
So, I mean, I think it's interesting. Well, two things. One, you're much better at the French company names than I would be. So I appreciate, laying that out for everybody, because if I had to do it, it would be in some form of Southern French English mess. But Keith, to that point, I mean, one thing that is interesting is there are these private equity players that Chloe had mentioned, and, you know, they've got to hold on to it for 10 years. I mean, this is a huge platform deal for them that everybody's looking at. I mean, do you think, one would assume they're going to have to hold it for 10 years, but that doesn't really follow the typical trajectory or path of a private equity firm, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, I guess there's a couple ways to look at it. One is that this isn't any other deal in the water sector, right? As you mentioned, it's sprawling. These are global portfolios in multiple market segments, regions, technologies. So it's complex. And as we can see, even with the interest expressed yesterday by Remondis, it's still kind of a fluid situation here. And there are a lot of heavy labor interests involved. There's a lot of politics involved in this. So for this thing to go through, obviously there's going to have to be some kind of commitment. And I think that, you know, the private equity players we're seeing stepping forward, showing interest, they're not any. I mean, Ardian's a pretty well established, very large fund in France. And so I think the type of fund and the type of deal makes this unique. That being said, you know, I think obviously there are broader concerns about just private equity in water in general, in terms of the returns that water assets can deliver. On the one hand, they're very interesting because it's very stable long-term. On the other hand, you know, are the costs of capital that a private equity player is facing and the tenor of, you know, the time horizons in which they hold on to investments tends to be significantly shorter. So with that, I think that there are a lot of moving parts to this, that some of the key parts around the Suez portfolio in France, for instance, that will probably have to stay put, but there are other pieces here that we could see being sold off, maybe parts of the international piece or other business divisions.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, the private equity piece is interesting, and I was just speaking with someone the other day, not directly really. Well, we talked about this deal, but there was also part of it, which we can get into in a minute, about just North Veolia, North America. But one of the points being made was, well, one, there's a lot of competition among private equity players. They're really pushing towards this sort of sustainability, resiliency, ESG focused investments, and water is part of that. And they're not a lot of big deals, right? So this is obviously a big one when we're talking, you know, $6 to $7 billion for these private equity players is a business. In fact, that's huge for water, a water deal, although it includes some waste. I think the other part of it is, you know, the concern that was raised by this one investor was that the near-term returns are not the issue. They'll deal with that down the road. Essentially, they're being really aggressive now, and they'll deal with what they paid or overpaid for some of these assets in the future, and their investors can deal with it then. So it's being really aggressive. And I think we also saw that just in what happened in the US with the New Mountain Infomark deal, or even the New Mountain Aegon or Apollo, depending on which way that goes. They're willing to spend big money at high multiples for those assets. Well, so I think one thing you brought up, and then Chloe, you brought it up, is you've got, you know, Veolia buying Suez, or a huge chunk, big chunk of it. It'll be a $37 billion euro company revenue-wise if this all goes through. But at the same time, a new Suez will be formed or sort of carved out of this. Well, what is that? That's like the other big piece, and that's where the PE players come in. So what does that include?
So the new SUEZ includes first municipal water and solid waste activities in France. From a competition point of view, the merger should not impact ongoing water and wastewater contracts, which prices are fixed and agreements are not to be renewed before several years. However, in the medium and long term, of course, competition authorities will have to remain vigilant as those contracts will expire and be tendered back. Actually, given the global footprint of Veolia and Suez, there's no doubt that market authorities in other countries will also have to look closely at the new deal. From an international point of view, international activities will only account for 25% of the new Suez, with water businesses in Italy, in the Czech Republic, in Africa, Central Asia, India, China, and Australia. The Lyonnaise des Eaux de Casablanca, a Moroccan subsidiary, will constitute the largest international activity of the new Suez, with 700 million euros of annual revenue. On the other side, the Spanish Agbar, the Aguas de Barcelona, and its subsidiaries in Latin America will go over to Veolia, as well as all the US municipal water activities.
So, yeah, I think the one thing is, Keith, I mean, we talked a little bit about this separately, and that is the whole, you know, you're obviously in Spain. We've done a fair amount of work with the Suez Spanish, with a team in Spain for Suez. What do you see there? I mean, because there is the digital, the SES business that's in Spain, but then you've got Agbar. Do you have any take or feelings on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is interesting. It's going to bring up some integration issues and just how the culture of Suez is going to change as it's split up. If you know a little bit about the history of Agbar being the Spanish water utility group that had a subsidiary called Aqualogy, which was quite innovative in developing different software tools, a metering tool, really getting on board pretty early with smart water solutions. And the advantage that they had was that they could pilot a lot of their systems on Agbar concessions around Spain. So, you know, if they had a leakage management software, they could deploy it in part of Barcelona or elsewhere in Spain to work out the kinks and come up with a marketable solution. And so Aqualogy then started growing outside of Spain. And when Suez took a larger stake in Agbar, that was kind of a key piece, was them being able to leverage the Aqualogy solutions into Suez's overall digital portfolio. And that evolved into the solutions that we know today as Aqua Advanced. So, you know, for us to have that kind of captive market, which Suez had in Spain for Aqualogy, that's going to change now. And there's been talk even before this deal that Suez might dispose of Agbar because it's been hard to grow a lot with those contracts. And Spain has incrementally become less receptive to private participation in municipal water, just as France has even before that. So it's not surprising that Agbar was going to change hands in one way or another. It definitely, though, is a bit of a blow to, I think, how SES originated. But, you know, it's going to have to push that unit to find other growth avenues.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, we talked about this early on when the deal was first announced, at least initially, and that was the cultural issues. And what does that mean? Because I think even in our experience, you know, when you're talking about the Aqualogy group, you're looking back at where the digital Aqua Advanced team, and they're coming up with digital solutions in Spain, and they're trying to deploy that around the world. There was even, you even run into friction among the Suez business groups internally. Now, it'll be interesting to see, maybe that gets better. Maybe it gets cleaned up. Does it become an easier process to move that around the world? Because the digital piece is a big, I mean, we see it at Bluefield as a big growth area. And obviously Suez did, you know, the Camus had seen that as an opportunity for growth as well. So it seems like that piece was a big bargaining chip in the whole deal, because it's interesting, as Chloe laid out, you know, you basically have the French contracts And then you've got Australia and you've got, you know, Czech Republic and a couple other hotspots. But really, at the end of the day, where's the growth coming? Because there's been pushback on some of the remunicipalization, some of those municipal contracts, there's definite public pressure. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I think the other part of the intrigue of this whole deal, because this has been going on for 8 months, and that is the Dutch poison pill. Nothing really came of it. It's now just being swept aside, correct? Chloe, I don't know, is that where we stand on that? That's a dead deal?
Yes, so the agreement between Suez and Veolia will deactivate the poison pill, as you said, that was put in place by Suez some months ago. So the idea was a Dutch foundation was to hold the Suez French assets, whose board members would have veto rights over any disposal. The new deal includes termination, also an agreement in which Suez planned to sell most of its Australian assets to clean away waste management.
Yeah, that was interesting. That deal happened. And I don't know if was that, do you know if that was part of a way of pushing back? Suez was selling its Australia assets, the waste assets or positions to clean away. Was that a way of sort of keeping Veolia at arm's length as part of the process? Because it was announced only like a month ago, a month and a half ago, and then suddenly it was like, hey, deal's done. Well, let's think about this going forward, because I think that's really where the interesting part of that is. So what do you think, Chloe, just to follow up, what does this mean going forward where we think the impact is going to be felt?
So first, it remains to be seen what will happen in the US. So the American activities of Suez were actually a major sticking point of the negotiations between the two competitors. Suez initially wanted to keep United Water, the second largest US provider of water and wastewater services, and to share parts of its water technology and solutions division, the WTS division, which is the ex-GE Water, to share that division with Veolia. During the negotiations, the balance of power quickly turned in favor of Veolia, and Suez actually accepted to give up its American activities in exchange for a price per share over 20 euros. And although the success is total for Veolia, the merger definitely proved expensive for the company. And the group is likely to divest several of its of Suez subsidiaries to offset the bill, such as the WTS division, as was privately expressed by Veolia's CEO.
One thing that's interesting about the North America deal is it wasn't all that long ago that there was a big rush by both companies, right? By Suez and Veolia. Obviously, Suez acquired the GE business, and that was mostly industrial and a much stronger North America position. But Veolia has also been saying essentially the same thing. Hey, North America is a growth area for industrials. It'll be interesting to see whether, one, the pandemic changes that in the aftermath of COVID and recession and what's happened globally, but also this deal. So the North America assets, I can't imagine they would just cast them aside. There seems to be real value there.
Right. So the US market was a core component for both these companies to grow. It was a mainstay of Suez's growth strategy, right? And acquiring GE. And I think we'll probably touch on that a little bit more here, but think that, as you were alluding to, Reese, there are several industrial verticals that did take a beating, particularly heavy industry, where large industrial water solutions firms like Suez and Veolia are kind of the only ones equipped to be building out water treatment for huge power plants or oil and gas operations. So that falling obviously puts more emphasis on trying to find growth in other industrial verticals where deals are smaller, there's probably more competition. And so you can see there how that may be a little bit less attractive in the near term. But, you know, it's hard to think of another market outside of the U.S., perhaps China, where Suez has gotten quite a foothold, that would be of more interest for trying to grow in industrial water. And particularly if the firm was not seeing the returns or the growth that it would like to see in a municipal, it seems that it would make sense to hold on to that. So I would anticipate quite a bit of shifting going on in the U.S. if that exit happens, and, you know, an opportunity obviously for smaller players to fill the void, and, you know, who's going to be the buyer of that unit as well would be interesting.
Yeah, I think, you know, not to focus too much on North America because that's only part of the deal, but they do have, there's a lot going on. I mean, they are Suez is an investor-owned utility in the U.S. They also provide services. They do the industrial through GE Water, and there's still friction between those groups and those acquisitions as they've rolled them up. I think that's just kind of the name of the game. These are big companies, right? And they're global, and they are all coming up with different solutions. But I think the other piece is, I mean, you mentioned China, Keith, and one of the questions I would have is, I think this even came out of, I don't know if it was part of the press release, but there was a question is, you know, that Veolia had raised and said, well, this is a way to compete with China. Is that really what this issue is? Is it a China, is that a, like a China scare tactic, you know, from the West? Because that helps justify the deal, or is it legitimate? I don't know if either one of you have any thoughts on that.
Look, having worked in the power industry and telecoms industry before in China, I mean, usually you get this sort of 5 to 7 year window of opportunity as a foreign player where you are addressing some midterm demand for a technology or service that doesn't exist yet in China. And the Chinese market does tend to grow its own solution relatively quickly, benefiting from some of that experience. And the 13th five-year plan that came out back in 2016, I believe it was, that laid out a much more aggressive plan for reducing industrial pollution. So far and away right now, the largest industrial wastewater treatment market is China. They fingered specific industries such as textile, tanneries, chemical, to a lesser extent, the power industry, as ones that need to be cleaned up because over 60% of China's surface water is contaminated. So huge opportunity right now for these companies, and not just Veolia and Suez, but we're also talking about probably Fluence, for instance, which announced a few key partnerships in China. So it's a big opportunity, but it's not going to be there forever. And eventually, you know, as I think we've been commenting, you know, eventually there will probably be one of these Chinese players that Chloe mentioned before, whether it's Beijing Enterprises Water Group or China Everbright, are building up their own expertise and their technology. And, you know, usually one of their first points of expansion will be probably in Southeast Asia, Philippines, for instance, or into Africa. Usually our target markets when they start to grow outside of China. So the short of it is there's an opportunity for them now. They need to try and be as competitive as possible because yes, eventually they'll start going head to head with Chinese rivals on the global stage.
So yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out because obviously the China market is big enough. They can all cut their teeth and sort of test their solutions there. And then ultimately, will they push with dollars and technology into other markets? I think, you know, we've looked at that in the past. I think the other question, or I guess point, then as I mentioned earlier on, I was talking to someone the other day about Veolia North America and sort of circling back on that. It looks like, Chloe, that this deal has sort of changed the outlook, right, of Veolia North America. We at Bluefield have been talking about the divestment of the Veolia North America assets for a while, but looks like that's off the table now.
I think China is a very interesting point because this was a recurring point in Veolia's CEO discourse over this merger with Suez. And actually, a few years ago, so the European railroad giants Alstom and Siemens tried unsuccessfully to merge together in an attempt to better compete with the Chinese juggernaut CRRC. The situation of the water sector is quite different from the railroad one, however. Today, China counts a handful of major water players, such as Beijing Capital, Beijing Enterprises Water Group, or China Everbright. The largest is the Beijing Enterprises Water Group, which has assets of around 16 billion euros. And that's actually three times less than Veolia's and two times less than Suez. Those two groups have still little international presence. Beijing Capital Group is present in New Zealand and in Poland, and Beijing Enterprises Water Group owns a German waste company. They are, however, definitely ambitious and benefit from a significant long-term financial power, also because they are backed by the Chinese government. Consolidation will most certainly lead to the emergence of a global Chinese player. But in the meantime, China remains in demand for foreign know-how. And Veolia and to a lesser extent Suez have definitely rushed into the breach and engaged in a battle for the allocation of water concessions in major Chinese cities and for waste management in China as well. Yes, so it seems that further to the announcement of the deal with Suez, Veolia has dropped the potential sale of its North American business. In the US, so Veolia operates water treatment plants and entire water systems and has been saddled by a number of large O&M positions that no one really like. For example, Veolia has been accused of being involved in the Flint, Michigan lead crisis after it was contracted to assess water quality for the city, accusations that the company has always rejected. Nonetheless, despite the positive signals sent by the high multiple paid by New Mountain Capital for Infomark last year that you were mentioning a few minutes ago, it seems that Veolia decided to put a hold to the sale of its North American business. It could signal that the group will first divest Suez U.S. municipal water business.
Yeah, I mean, they could just flip it around. It'll be interesting to see what happens. Like I said, you know, Veolia has some big contracts out there. They have some large concessions. I think Indianapolis is one, and they're long. And I think the discussions I've had with people who've either participated in those deals is, I don't know if either side of the deal is happy, whether it be Veolia with a, you know, contract, trying to, you know, get more returns out of it, but also the municipality or municipalities themselves, they're frustrated and they say, wow, we're stuck with this for, you know, not just 10 years, not just 15, in some cases longer than that. So these are big deals that have sort of maybe weighing on Veolia a little bit. The other part of it is in contrast to Suez, Veolia has been, I think, more involved in the energy space as well. And, you know, they have some positions like in the Marcellus or the Appalachian Basin for fracking, where they've got, I think they're working with, I'm testing my memory now, but I think it was Antero. They put, you know, it was a $275 million treatment plan in the Marcellus. And the energy market as a whole has been incredibly volatile. And that in and of itself is changing. So, you know, early on they said, oh, there's enough capacity or demand for five more plants for fracking, you know, treatment plants to reuse, reclaim produced water from the wells. And it doesn't seem to be the case. I think the market is kind of is slowed a bit in many cases. So that's a tough market and a tough investment that they had made that obviously doesn't seem to be paying off. So, well, I don't know, Keith, is there anything else that we missed on this deal that's worth circling back on or pointing out?
Well, I think I'd just like to reiterate the point that this deal can mean a lot of things to a lot of different parties. So I think, again, because if they are sprawling multi-regional portfolios, there may be opportunity to pick up some assets, whether you're Remondis in Germany or you're an investor-owned utility group in the US, or you're looking to get some industrial projects in Southeast Asia. They're everywhere. And so it's obviously why all eyes are on how this is going to shake out. And I think that it's an exciting time to see how, you know, hopefully some good could come out of this in terms of delivering more value to all the stakeholders involved. And, you know, I think there's definitely going to be some pushback here about getting private equity involved in a private water utility and involved in a heavily regulated public sector. But at the same time, you know, this could lead to some innovation in some different areas, and look forward to watching that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, as you say that, you know, I think we've talked about, oh, there's, you know, challenges, there's the China deal, there's sort of the cultural issues. But on the other side of the deal, there ultimately may be a lot of opportunity. And I'm positive about it in the sense that the digital business, the Aqua Advance, I think there's real opportunity there. So the new Suez could really be unshackled from, you know, a lot of the other positions that Suez may hold and maybe a growth opportunity. I mean, if anything, you know, when you break up companies, sometimes it drives innovation and change. There's also an opportunity, like you said, for outside investors to potentially secure a platform position for growth. And then, you know, I think it signals an opportunity for companies to compete with them. There may be a bit of a vacuum. Keith, you and I talked about that in our last podcast. If as Suez and Veolia sort through the mess, other companies that they compete against in various markets could find an opportunity where they can have the conversation and say, hey, yeah, we compete with Veolia and Suez, but look what's going on over there. They're trying to clean house and sort of put things in order, but we can help you out right now. All right. Well, look, guys, this is super helpful and really appreciate you stepping up. And Chloe, thanks for, I guess, are you still in quarantine?
No, we're still in the lockdown, unfortunately.
So France is in lockdown. Keith, you're not in lockdown, but it kind of feels that way, I assume.
Yeah, Barcelona, it's getting better. I think vaccination is really starting to ramp up here and we're allowed to move around the different regions of Spain. So the future is bright. Future of water is bright. Future of the next few months is looking brighter.
And I've told both of you guys this, and definitely you, Keith, is that it felt the same way 2 months ago in the US. You would have said, oh my God, we're never getting out of this. This is a complete disaster. Not only have 550,000 people died, we can't even get vaccinated. This is insane. We should have been planning for this all along. And now it's not even May and I'm already vaccinated. So it's kind of crazy. So who would have thought? And now I think even the CDC in the US announced that if you're vaccinated, you can walk around town without a mask. So that's that'll be nice to get rid of the mask at some point. So, but all right, guys. Well, thanks again for enlightening us on what's happening with this deal, and look forward to seeing how it plays out going forward. You guys take care.
Thanks, Reese. Take care.
So before we sign off, please subscribe and give the Future Water Podcast a review. Send us a note separately to waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com with any topic ideas you would like us to discuss. We're doing this for you, so we want to provide you the best insights we can. Lastly, tell a friend about it. We're still in a pandemic, although in the US we seem to be coming out of it, but it's no better time to reach out and share some thoughts and insights on water. So this podcast and these water industry insights have been brought to you by the one and only Bluefield Research. To learn more about us, visit bluefieldresearch.com. Until we talk again, be safe, be well, take care.